Adventures of Donald McQueen, Bibliographer. Chapter 1, The Ear Trumpet of Death. My name is Donald McQueen, and I am a bibliographer. Everyone calls me Queenie McQueen. They call me Queenie because of my surname, just as Ozzy Osbourne, for example, is called Ozzy because his surname is Osbourne, and not because he is in any way Australian. I'm called Queenie not because I am in the least bit Queenie, but because my surname is McQueen. I hope that's clear. My name is Donald McQueen, and I'm a bibliographer, and these are my adventures. I live in the ancient university town of Knoxford, nestling in the Plum Valley, where I am Professor Emeritus of Bibliography and a fellow of both Timor Mortis College and of Unruly House. I spend much of my time in the Fellows Library of my college, and one morning as I entered the panelled anteroom, I noticed, shining upon the floor, a small, bent trumpet. I stooped to pick it up and examined it. The mouthpiece was of ivory and strangely wrought. There was some yellowish, waxy substance adhering to it, and I realized all at once that this was not a musical trumpet, but an ear trumpet. I wiped it on my bibliographer's smock and fitted the ivory earpiece to my ear.
You'll never take me alive, copper.
Now, booger, I've lost me quill.
Blimey, Caxton, this one's exactly the same. And this one, and this one, they're all the bloody same.
I perceived that this was no ordinary hearing aid, but was, in fact, the ear trumpet of death. I knew this somehow, telepathically, and because there was a small monogram D on the socle of the trumpet, which could only stand for death. I cast around in my mind for someone else in the college with the initial D, and entertained for a moment the fancy that the instrument might belong to Dulciana Dashwood of the extortion department. But I could hardly have pictured her with an ear trumpet. Gingerly, I put the miraculous tube to my ear again.
I would do anything for love, Camilla, but I won't do that.
I have some bad news for you. I'm afraid your leopard is completely deaf.
Engage the interstellar overdrive.
I perceive that everything I heard through the trumpet was real and true. I was hearing sounds from the past and also from the future, and from the minds of the beasts of the field, from nearby planets, and sometimes, too, from alternative realities. In short, all the data that Death might need in his quotidian work. In a thoughtful mood, I carried the trumpet through to the Fellows Library. As I passed the portraits of the college's benefactors and famous alumni, which hung above the windows in the bays between the bookcases, I wondered what they would have made of such a powerful, indeed terrifying, instrument. There was Philip Ashby, the third Earl Seton, and there Sir William Peveril, who funded the erection of the Great Hall in 1556. There was Delia Smith, authoress of the Cheats Cookbook, and there Great Uncle Bulgaria, by far the most influential of the Wombles. As I took my usual chair beneath the marble bust of Superman, who'd have thought that mild-mannered Clarkson Kent, a Rhodes Scholar from Idaho, would turn out to be, in fact, from the planet Krypton, I asked myself a series of probing questions. Where was Death? Why had he or she been here? How had he or she lost his or her ear trumpet? What would he or she, let's stick with he, what would he do without it? Would he seek to find it again? Was my own life, in fact, in danger? With the trumpet on the lectern before me, I wondered what to do with it. Could I use it in my bibliographical research? All thoughts of the riddle of the Codex Asinorum, which had occupied my mind for the past 18 years, had, I confess, fled. Could I use the trumpet to determine my own destiny, or that of my fellows? Dared I reach again into the future or the past, or to some distant planet or alternative reality? I am Donald McQueen, bibliographer, and, of course, I dared. Soon I recognized the voices of two professors of the history faculty, Caliban Dale and Falstaff Willoughby. Perhaps their conversation was happening right now, but no, they sounded older, more cracked and crabbed than ever. I was listening in to the future.
I should like you to tell me more, please, Willoughby.
Well, my theory concerns the leaders of the Third Reich, and is founded upon my discovery that Adolf Hitler had only ever been to one ball.
Really?
Yes, and oddly enough, that was held in the Albert Hall. It seems his mother cut him off from the social world when he was small.
You amaze me. What of the other Nazi leaders? What, for example, of Göring?
Oh, well, Göring had attended two balls, but both, it seems, were unusually small affairs.
And Himmler?
Himmler was somewhat similar.
And Goebbels?
No balls at all for poor old Goebbels, I'm afraid.
Well, that does explain a great deal. I'd often wondered why they were so socially inept, those Nazis, huh? In amazement, I withdrew the trumpet from my ear. Here was an object of almost immeasurable power and importance, which could tell me almost any truth and answer any question of history, or, more thrillingly, futurity. I once more fitted the ivory earpiece to my lug hole. Curiously, I seemed now to have tuned into the wireless, picking up the local station, BBC Radio Knoxford, from the future.
Now on Radio Knoxford, the latest in our series of dramatizations of little-known or recently discovered Victorian tales of terror. This week, we present Bram Stoker's unpublished sequel to his Dracula of 1897, dramatized from the manuscript found in the Stoker archive at Lady Marmalade College, Cambridge. We present Count Flatula, her vampire with a problem.
Flatula by Abraham Stoker, starring Featherstone Crumbleback and Simon Callow III. Myself. I am Count Vladislaw Flatula, and for many years I was, in my native land of Transylvania, an outcast. I will spare the gentle listener the details of my affliction, and will say only that, since time began, or shortly after time began, no mortal man could bear the company of one of my kinsmen or of myself. My story is a tragic one. For years I dwelt alone in my castle. No servant would stay in my employment, and no friend would call. I cooked for myself, even hunted for my own food in the woods. You cannot imagine how it hurt a proud count such as I to be obliged to act so. One day, when I was creeping through the forest with my gun, surrounded by a cloud of noxious gas,
which caused the little creatures of the wood to flee before me, and the birds to drop, stone dead, from the trees, I saw a beautiful doe upon a hillock in a clearing. I raised my gun and shot her dead. I wept to see what a lovely innocent creature I had killed, but I had to eat. Just as I was about to hoist her body onto my mighty shoulder, on a whim I dipped my finger into the bullet wound upon her breast and licked it, tasting the warm blood of her ebbing life. Instantly something changed within me. I felt a surging in my bowels, and great clouds of gas burst forth. This was nothing new, of course, but this gas was different. It was not foul. It was sweet. At once, I heard the birds singing around me, and a rabbit, or a squirrel, or some such creature, emerged from the undergrowth and regarded me with soft, curious eyes. I reached into the wound on the doe's breast and took a little more of her blood. The reaction was the same, but more so. The air grew sweet. A throstle landed upon the butt of my gun and started to sing. A second rabbit, or squirrel, joined the first, and they began to kiss. I drained the blood of the beautiful doe and drank it all. It tasted like honey, and for some 12 hours equally sweet were my bowels. I glimpsed a possible life for myself in which other humans, friends, perhaps even lovers, featured. I longed for a young man or woman, for I am an AC/DC count, who would not run, choking from my presence, or die upon the instant when I enveloped them with my cloud. But my joy faded as the effects of the blood of the doe diminished. I had to find more blood. I bought a bottle of Gruber's tomato ketchup, but although it was delicious and the ideal accompaniment to any savory dish, it had not the same effect upon my below-the-waist exhalations. And so began my life of craving. Where once I had been the victim of a curse of foul gases, now was I cursed with hunger for blood. At first, I drank the blood of animals I had hunted and killed in the forest, but each of these, when fully drained, could keep my emissions sweet only for a short while. Then, one day, by the stream that ran through the wood, I saw a young woman washing her clothes in the bright water. And I leapt upon her and strangled her, and I hung her up by her ankles in a tree, and slit her throat, and lay beneath her on the ground, with my mouth open, and drank almost all of her blood. I was ashamed of my crime, but I could not help myself. I smelled her blood, and I thirsted for it. And it had a wonderful effect upon my accursed digestion. Lovely odors flowed gently de profundis, as if I had devoured 1,000 roses and quaffed a barrel of Chanel No. 9. It lasted for a full week. 7 days in paradise, I made a friend. I made 2 friends, and I groped a barmaid at the sign of the wild man, and she did not die or scream, although she did not, I think, particularly enjoy it. When I told her I was a count, she let me grope her again. Such was my joy. I had to find more blood to drink, and found that it was only human blood which could satisfy me for any period. I discovered that the younger my victim, the longer would be the sweetening effect of its life blood. I drained a little boy, and my arse was sweet for a fortnight. I stroked 7 beautiful kittens in this time, and had a puppy in my lap for nearly 45 minutes. And I drank cognac with a man called Wilhelm, who had little conversation but very pretty eyes. And I danced with a young sailor who was, I am afraid, very drunk indeed. Then, to my shame, I extracted an infant from the local orphanage and sucked him dry beneath the full moon. I was free of foul odors, indeed surrounded by the scents of heaven for a full month, and lost at last my cherry, twice, to a tramp with the body of Adonis, and then to a lady postman, who called at my castle to deliver a most mysterious package.
What was inside that most mysterious package? Will the Count's crimes find him out? Will he be able to retain his newfound perfume while concealing his dreadful secret? Find out in the next thrilling episode of Count Flatula, a vampire with a problem. I was drawn away from that remarkable broadcast and heard instead what seemed to be the interior of a shop in the north of Wales, whose avatar was the ringing of a mercantile bell.
Good afternoon, sir, and how can I help yourself?
I wish to complain about this tin of dolphin-friendly tuna which I bought here last week.
Ooh, I am sorry to hear that. What was the problem, sir? Was the tuna not succulent and delicious enough for yourself? Was it not, perhaps, sufficiently dolphin-friendly? Did it make, perchance, an off-colour remark about dolphins being, in truth, barely more intelligent than krill? Did it mutter, perhaps, when you opened the tin, that dolphins are always expecting tuna to be friendly to them, without ever reciprocating that same warmth? Did it make, I wonder, a coarse and casually dolphinist joke concerning blowholes?
No, nothing like that, I can assure you.
Well, then, what seems to be the trouble?
I opened the can last night, intending to add some tuna and mayonnaise to a baked potato, only to find that the tin was virtually empty, or rather, it was virtually full of salty water, with only one very small fragment of grey meat.
Ah, the clouds begin to clear. May I see the can, please? Thank you. Thank you. Yes, I perceive that you are mistaken. This is not a tin of dolphin-friendly tuna.
No?
No, indeed. Kindly read the label again, sir. What does it say?
Tuna-friendly tuna.
Quite so. No tuna were harmed in the manufacture and processing of this product.
So this is a tin of tuna-friendly tuna. In other words, it's an empty tin.
No, not at all, sir. It contains fresh seawater through which a shoal of happy tuna have swum.
And this little bit of meat? What's this?
Well, sir, when the cannery was manufacturing this product, they did accidentally kill a couple of dolphins. You should consider yourself very lucky to have got a little bit of one of them there.
I had no interest in obscure shops with Welsh proprietors, nor indeed in the fishes of the sea, so again withdrew the wondrous instrument from my ear and laid it upon the lectern before me. I had passed the whole day listening to the miraculous ear trumpet of death here in the college library without looking at a single codex, and I had missed lunch. This had never happened before. I rose from my favourite chair beneath the bust of Superman. The clock ticked gently, the fire crackled, there was no one else in the place. I slipped the trumpet into the voluminous back pocket of my bibliographer's smock and began to make my weary way towards my college rooms, where the latest volume from the Bibliographical Society lay unopened upon the bed, and my beloved cat Dogrel was waiting for me, no doubt in my favourite wing chair beside the fireplace. Later, I would dine in the great hall, perhaps accompanying my second, third, and fifth courses with Gruber's tomato ketchup, the ideal accompaniment to any savoury dish, and then retire and muse upon the discoveries of the day. As I entered the quadrangle, I stumbled over an object lying on the steps of the library portico. I kicked it and turned it over, and found it to be the body of the old librarian, Hogg. No one knew his forename. Probably he did not possess one. He was quite dead, by which I mean he was completely dead, not that he was somewhat dead. This explained one of the mysteries of the day. Clearly death had called here for old Hogg and dropped his ear trumpet in the prosecution of this benign duty. The librarian must have been taken some time that morning, but no one had found his body until now, when it was early evening. I looked round the quad. There was no one else to be seen, so decided against raising the alarm and left the corpse where it lay for the domestics to find as soon as they chanced upon it.
The Adventures of Donald McQueen, Bibliographer. Today's chapter was sponsored by the Bibliographical Society of London and by Gruber's Tomato Ketchup, the ketchup of bibliographers. It was written and performed by Paul W. Nash. Next time on The Adventures of Donald McQueen, Bibliographer. The cases of my friend Sherlock Holmes, which I have, in a small way, endeavoured to record for posterity in these memoirs, came to him in a great variety of ways. There was the adventure of the extra verb, which began when a parrot was delivered, arrived at Baker Street, a parrot which was unable to speak, incapable of enunciating, without using, employing, two verbs every time a single verb was called for, required. This quickly became very irritating. The case was never solved, for Holmes grew furious with the parrot and killed it with his swordstick. Then there was the problem of the empty cage, which had nothing to do with the verbose parrot, but concerned the disappearance of an elephant from Pawson's Wild Beast Show. The creature had apparently been abstracted by kidnappers, but without disturbing its great cage or unfastening the complex lock,
which held its door firmly shut. The case was a triumph for my friend's powers of observation and deduction, and he ultimately proved, from a study of the footprints left in the sawdust and mud of the circus site, that the elephant had not been kidnapped at all, but had effected his own escape by a remarkable show of intelligence in order to elope with a lady elephant from another wild beast show. Holmes traced them to a small cottage on the Scotch border. The case came to us in the most singular fashion when Rice Canticle, the elephant's unhappy keeper, marched into our sitting room and deposited some 17 pounds of dung on the breakfast table. It was not his own dung, of course, but the elephant's, and all that had been left in the creature's otherwise empty cage. This was a curious enough beginning to a case, but exceeded, I think, for grotesque strangeness, by the manner in which began The Adventure of the Golden Parsnip. It started, as so many of our cases did, with a ring upon the doorbell. After a minute or so, a youngish man was ushered into our rooms. He was tall and thin, almost too thin, with a pale face fringed with yellow whiskers. He wore a black top hat, to which was pinned the scarlet badge of the Shepherd's Bush Racists League, and carried in his hands a brown paper bag, stained with what looked like blood. Holmes rose to greet him.
"Oh, forgive me for calling unannounced, Mr. Holmes,"
said our visitor.
"But I am at my wit's end. My name is Curry Windicoot, and the most extraordinary punishment has been visited upon me, and I cannot, for the life of me, understand what I am being punished for." "Ah, my dear Mr. Windicoot,"
said Holmes,
"please take off your hat and coat and take a seat beside the fire. That's right. Thank you. This gentleman is my friend and colleague, Dr. Watson, before whom you may speak as you would before me. Now, permit me to hang your hat and coat upon the stand while you make yourself comfortable."
Sherlock Holmes took our visitor's outdoor clothes to the corner of the room. He paused for a moment and scratched his head.
"I regret, Mr. Windicoot, that we no longer have a hat stand. Ever since the case which my chronicler here entitled The Adventure of the Disappearing Hat Stand, I have been unable to hang my guests' hats and coats. I will place yours carefully here upon the floor, if I may."
"Holmes," I said, "we really should get a new hat stand."
"No, Watson, I will solve the case."
"I don't think so, Holmes. I really don't."
Will Sherlock Holmes solve the case of the disappearing hat stand? What is contained in the brown paper bag held by Mr. Windicoot? What is the nature of the singular punishment which has been visited upon him? Find out in the next exciting chapter of The Adventures of Donald McQueen, Bibliographer.
Fetch me the Codex, Asinor.